Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, the Honourable Jay Weatherill, the Premier of South Australia, the Honourable Grace Bortolesi, MP, Ms Isabel Redmond, MP, Leader of the Opposition, Ms Vicky Chapman, MP, Mr Stephen Marshall, MP, and Councillor Megan Hender, representing Mr Stephen Yarwood, the Lord Mayor of the City of Adelaide, who's taken ill tonight. My name is Sam Shaheen, and I'm a member of the executive of the Australian Friends of Palestine Association. Welcome to the 7th Edward Said Memorial Lecture, brought to South Australia by the Australian Friends of Palestine Association in conjunction with the University of Adelaide. The Edward Said Memorial Lecture has become established as a marquee event in South Australia, and indeed a model for similar events around Australia. We are privileged today to hear one of the world's most distinguished authors, human rights campaigners, and one of the world's greatest thinkers. To reinforce this point, I quote the US Arts and Humanities Citation Index that stated that between 1980 and 1992, Professor Chomsky was the most cited living person in that period, and the eighth most cited source overall for all publications. Indeed, Professor Chomsky is an illustrious company, the seven cited sources ahead of him being Marx, Lenin, Shakespeare, Aristotle, the Bible, Plato, and Freud. We are indeed in illustrious company today. A word on today's proceedings. You will hear first from Professor Bassam Daly, head of the School of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Adelaide, who co-sponsored this event. Please welcome Professor Daly.
We'll have Professor Daly speak first.
Thank you, Sam. Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to begin by acknowledging that this event is being held on the land of the Kaurna people, the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains, and the land at which the University of Adelaide campuses are built. Welcome to the 7th Edward Said Memorial Lecture at the University of Adelaide. My name is Bassam Daly, and I'm the member of the academic staff at the university and a convener of the steering committee of this lecture. The committee is made of academics from the university, members of the Australian Friends of Palestine Association, who obviously are sponsor of this lecture. It was in 2005 when the whole idea started, and I'm really pleased to see so many people here in the crowd today. This lecture is going from strength to strength. Said was passionate about many and varied topics in addition to his specialization in comparative literature. He argued that intellectual had a specific public role in society that cannot be reduced simply to being a faceless professional. In this context, and in honor of Said's remarkable vision, we hold this lecture to also encourage people to become what he termed amateur intellectuals, who inform themselves and contribute to the public debate and discourse on issues that matter to our society and humanity in general. Said was unique in the rigor of his research, depth of his knowledge, and breadth of his interest. Said, the humanist, cared equally for his people, the Palestinians, the same way he cared for the Jews in Israel. Said, the activist, was highly critical of corrupt regimes, racist ideologies, and US hegemony, while Said, the musician, could have easily replaced the lectern with a piano. Similar lectures are held in many cities around the world, in places including Columbia University, University of Warwick, Princeton University, American University of Cairo, and Palestine Center. The Adelaide lecture is among the best of them, attracting leading intellectuals who have refused to tie themselves down to a speciality. I'd like to go through them. In 2005, we had Robert Fisk, he's a journalist. In 2006, we had the late Tanya Reinhardt, who is a linguist. And the late Professor Reinhardt was a student of Professor Chomsky. In 2007, we have Lada Kami, who is a medical doctor. And in 2008, we had Sarah Roy, who's an economist. In 2009, we had Sari Maktisi, who's the nephew of Said, and his specialty is English and comparative literature. And in 2010, some of you would have attended, we had Tariq Ali, who's an activist and author. It's quite a challenging task for the steering committee to choose a speaker every year. It will deliver a lecture which encapsulates Said's vision, virtues, and give the audience food for thought, which we don't usually get from our mainstream media. And we are always pleased and grateful to those intellectuals from different parts of the world who heed our call and travel from afar to deliver a lecture that carries the vision of the late Said. On this occasion, I'd like briefly to share with you an extract from a poem by the late Mahmoud Darwish. Darwish is a famous Palestinian poet. He was a close friend of Edward Said. The poem is titled Passport, or Jawaz Safar in Arabic. This particular poem became a very popular song by Marcel Khalifi. And I thought this has special relevance with the expected vote on Palestinian statehood in the UN later this month. So the title is Passport, Mahmoud Darwish, Palestine. They didn't recognize me in the shadows that suck away the colors in this passport. And to them, my wounds was an exhibit for a tourist who loves to collect photographs. They didn't recognize me. Don't leave. All the wheat fields, all the prisons, all the white tombstones, all the barbed boundaries, all the waving handkerchiefs, all the eyes were with me. But they dropped them from my passport, stripped of my name and identity, on a soul I nourished with my own hands. Today, job carried out, filling the sky. Don't make an example of me again. Oh, gentlemen prophets, don't ask the trees for their names. Don't ask the valleys for their mother. From my forehand bears the sword of light, and from my hand springs the water of the river. All the hearts of the people are my identity, so take away my passport. Finally, I'd like to thank the University of Adelaide for hosting this lecture, and thank many of the dedicated friends and colleagues for the help. In particular, Dr. Sam Shaheen worked tirelessly for this particular event. Him and his staff are much acknowledged and thanked for their effort. I'd like to also warmly acknowledge the generous sponsorship of AFOBA. Without the support, it would have been impossible to put this lecture on every year. And last but not least, I'd like to thank all of you for your support and patronage. Enjoy the lecture. Thank you.
Thank you, Bassam. I will now introduce Mr. Paul Hayward-Smith, QC, the Chairman of the Australian Friends of Palestine Association.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my task this afternoon to introduce our speaker. For somebody who's been involved in six prior Edward Said Memorial Lectures, and feeling that I have a handle upon the capacity to bring people out in Adelaide on the issue of Palestine, I consider that we in AFOPA must regard ourselves as extremely fortunate to have Noam Chomsky here to assist us. This lecture has not been advertised, and the Australian press has been reluctant to publicise our speaker's visit. May I say something about AFOPA? The association is now 8 years old. Its object is to promote peace in the Middle East through compliance with United Nations resolutions and application of international law. It seeks the implementation of the International Court of Justice's decision of 2004 on the legality of the wall. It presses for the application of human rights law to all peoples of Palestine. Nothing much radical there, you would think. In world terms, AFOPA is totally mainstream. Witness the vote on the admission of Palestine to UNESCO this week. In Australia, however, we are painted, particularly by such organs as the Murdoch Press and like-minded media outlets, as dangerously radical. The policy of the Greens on Palestine is consistent with world opinion, yet it is painted as part of the loony left as a result by such organs as the Australian. It beggars belief that our government would have voted no to Palestine's membership of UNESCO. May I be forgiven for indulging myself on Professor Chomsky's behalf? The article by Brendan O'Neill in Today's Australian is, in my view, typical. The article was supposedly about the Sydney Peace Prize. Not one word appeared as to why the award was given. The Australian obviously does not see that as a fruitful field of discussion. In ignoring that, the Australian, in my view, convicted itself as guilty of the very thing that it is critical of Noam Chomsky about, his assertion of the manipulation by the conservative media of public attitudes. I feel somewhat inadequate to introduce our speaker. Noam Chomsky is, of course, the Professor of Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and has been for many years. I think, in fact, this is his 50th anniversary as professor. But I deduce that he is equally well known today for his political activism. He is the one who has led us to question what we read and are told by our governments. He is the one who has encouraged us to take a sceptical attitude towards anything that is advanced as conventional wisdom. He is the one, perhaps as the result of his particular expertise as a linguist, who has invited us to question phrases such as peace process, international community, US aid, honest broker. He is the one who would point out what should be the obvious, but isn't. Like, is there not something curious, indeed perverse, in Hillary Clinton warning Iran not to meddle in Iraq's affairs? This is, of course, the Edward Said Memorial Lecture. It is an annual lecture which honours the memory of Edward Said. Noam Chomsky's presence here today, if it is possible for it to be done, adds lustre to the name of Edward Said. I, however, have said enough. You've not come here today to listen to me. But before I close, I do wish to acknowledge the efforts of Dr. Sam Shaheen in doggedly pursuing our speaker and not lightly taking no for an answer. Thank you, Sam. Ladies and gentlemen, the Australian Friends of Palestine Association and the University of Adelaide presents Noam Chomsky.
Very much for the warm welcome. This is actually the fourth time that I've had the privilege of giving a talk in memory of Edward Said, who was an old close friend for many years. First time was in Beirut. then Columbia University, where he taught and where we in fact shared many platforms on these issues, and finally in Princeton. And it's of course always tinged with deep regret that he's no longer with us, enhanced by the recognition of how much we really need the incisive critical analysis that he provided and his simple integrity. The topic I'd like to talk about is one that was of primary concern for Edward for most of his life. He was, in fact, one of the few who did not succumb to illusions or to powerful pressures, doctrinal and otherwise, and in his case, in fact, quite serious threats to his life, taken very seriously by the police, in fact. And he continued forthrightly to expose what was happening, in fact, not sparing anyone his critical eye. Well, a good place to start with this topic is to borrow a concept from a very fine young British diplomatic historian, Mark Curtis, author of quite important studies on Britain's post-World War II imperial crimes. It's the concept unpeople, that is, creatures who look human, but are not really human, they're not actually people, and therefore they don't merit elementary human rights. That happens to be highly relevant to this topic. Now, that distinction is ever present. Take a couple of weeks ago, for example, there was an assassination in Yemen of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen, a cleric, a Muslim cleric. The headline, killed by a drone, the headline in the New York Times read, "The West celebrates a cleric's death." Death is not quite accurate. It was an assassination, an important escalation of President Obama's global assassination campaign. Not everyone celebrated. There were a few critics. Among them, almost all were critics because a person assassinated was an American citizen. That is a person. That's unlike suspects who are intentionally murdered or victims of what's called collateral damage, somebody who happens to be in the wrong place, who are not citizens. There's no problem because they are unpeople, and therefore they can be freely murdered. I use the word suspect because, being old-fashioned, I can recall that a long time ago there was a crucial conception in Anglo-American law called presumption of innocence. That is, a person's innocent until proven guilty in proper proceedings in a court of law. That has so long been abandoned, and it's so deeply hidden that we can, it sounds like you're talking about the Stone Age when you bring it up, never discussed. Well, some of the critics brought up the U.S. Constitution, which states unequivocally that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, notice that that was not intended to be applied to unpeople, even those within U.S. territory, actual territory, or soon to be acquired, the native population. They're unpeople, so they can be deprived of life and property quite freely. Nor was it intended to apply to those who the Constitution determined to be only three-fifths human, that is, the huge slave population. In fact, it barely applied to women who had very restricted rights. The three-fifths human they advanced to full human with the 14th Amendment a couple of years after the Civil War, at least in theory, not in fact, shortly after virtual slavery was reintroduced in some ways harsher than the original form by the divisive criminalization of black life. Extremely ugly story, not as well known as it should be. And in fact, that's being renewed in the past 30 years of very high criminalization, which has essentially the same effect and the same targets. It's a period of severe social and moral regression, not just in the United States. Well, the 14th Amendment was recognized right away to be problematic. The point is that the concept person was too narrow and too broad. And the courts went to work right away to remedy these flaws. They broadened the concept person to include collectivist legal fictions established and sustained by state power, what are called corporations. And over the years, the courts and other agreements have given them rights that go far beyond persons of flesh and blood. That includes, in the last few years, the misnamed free trade agreements. It was also narrow. The concept was also narrowed because it was too broad. It had to be narrowed to exclude undocumented aliens. They have to be unpeople, that is, not covered by the Constitution. And in fact, both of these issues, the broadening of the concept and the narrowing of it, are very live issues in the courts and in public discourse right now. And of course, the concept excludes foreigners, particularly if they're suspected of terrorism. Suspected, remember. If they're suspected of terrorism, they're certainly unpeople. And now that's been extended to American citizens, which, as I say, aroused a little bit of discussion. The concept of terrorist also has taken on quite an interesting meaning in the past 30 years in the context of the global war on terror, as it's called. That was actually initiated by Ronald Reagan in 1981, redeclared by George W. Bush 20 years later. A lot to say about this 30-year global war on terror, but I won't go into it, except to note how the term terrorist is now used, and indeed used without comment. That's a matter that bears quite directly on the obstacles to a just peace in the former Palestine. So take, for example, Omar Khadr. He's the first person to have been brought before a military commission under President Obama. There had been some brought to military commissions under Bush, but those cases were all thrown out by the Supreme Court, the very right-wing Supreme Court, but those violations of due process were too much even for them. And so Omar Khadr is the first one brought under Obama's very marginal revisions of the provisions thrown out by the court. And he was accused of a very serious crime. Omar Khadr is a 15-year-old boy. He was accused of having defended his village when it was attacked by American soldiers in Afghanistan. He was even accused of picking up a grenade and throwing it at the invading soldiers. Well, that's pretty serious. So a 15-year-old child was sent to the secret prison in Bagram, and after a year sent on to Guantanamo for another 7 years. This, of course, in gross violation of international law, in particular the quite explicit provisions of international law about proper treatment of juveniles. Remember, he's a 15-year-old boy. But those are ignored in terrorist states, so there's no comment about them. After 8 years in detention, the first few years you couldn't see a lawyer, you know what goes on in Guantanamo, so I won't discuss it. But after 8 years of this, he was brought to trial, and he pleaded guilty to avoid a very long prison sentence for this serious crime. We all know what it means to plead guilty under those conditions. He was therefore given only 8 years additional sentencing. Now, he's a Canadian citizen. Canada can have him extradited, but courageously, Canada's unwilling to offend the master. There may be some resonances of that decision here. I leave that to you. The crime of resisting aggression is a very interesting category of terrorism. It's not entirely new. Some of you may remember the slogan, terror against terror, used by the Gestapo. None of this arouses any interest. None of it arouses any discussion. Omar Khadr belongs to the category of unpeople, so he's fair game. And pretty much the same is true in the occupied territories. There's a very fine Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem. They just came out a couple of weeks ago with a new report. It's called No Minor Matter. It's about the treatment of minors under occupation. And it's worth reading. It gives many ugly illustrations to support their conclusion. I'll just read it. The rights of Palestinian minors are flagrantly violated at every stage of the proceedings conducted against them, from the initial arrest and removal from their homes, through interrogation and trial, to serving the prison sentence and follows with release. And more generally, the concept of unpeople is central to any consideration of tonight's topic. Israeli Jews are people. Palestinians are unpeople. And almost everything that happens follows from that. There are clear illustrations regularly in the press. In fact, this morning, in the Australian press this morning, The Age, Sydney Morning Herald, there's a very graphic story of the treatment of unpeople. I clipped it from The Age. It's about a Palestinian woman, actually an Israeli citizen, a Bedouin living in the south of Israel. Her name is Rifa Okbi, articles by Ruth Pollard. And it's a description of what happened in her village recently. It's the pictures of the young woman and her two little boys. The Israeli army showed up. Ordered them to leave their home because it was going to be bulldozed. She asked for 24 hours to collect some furniture and possessions. Wasn't allowed that. She tried to reach for something to take and was beaten and thrown to the ground. Somebody tried to help her. He was beaten up. And then they destroyed the home. This is part of a broader program of getting rid of 45 unregistered villages. Unregistered, these are villages to which Bedouin were driven when they were driven off their lands in 1948. I've visited some of them and heard plenty of complaints about what happens. They don't get services. They don't get running water, electricity, social services, or schools. Remember, these are Israeli citizens. They serve in the army, they vote, they pay taxes, but they're unpeople. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu met with the mayors of the villages, these 45 villages, and he explained to them that this is really a humanitarian endeavor. The reason is that it's two reasons. One is that Israel is replacing the unpeople with people. That is, as he put it, they want to attract a new population in the Negev, the south of Israel. And nobody could object to replacing unpeople with people, obviously. The second reason is why it's a humanitarian gesture is that now, I'm quoting him, Netanyahu said that the plan would allow the Bedouin for the first time to realize their assets and turn them from dead capital into living capital. In short, they were living in villages, but that's dead capital, and it was treated that way. But now, as a gesture of humanitarianism, 10 of the villages will be registered, so therefore they can be treated like other villages, and that gives the people live capital. Well, this is happening, that's today, but any, you can find it almost any day that you look. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a prisoner exchange, as you know, New York Times, front page story, release of Corporal Gilad Shalit, picture across the top of the front page of four women who were had been sitting in, protesting the fact that the government had not arranged an exchange that would release him. There were a few things missing in the story. What about the Palestinians? So no pictures of anybody mourning about them, no names, I can't find their names, no comment on how they were treated when they were released, what condition they were in. There was one question raised about the Palestinians. Will they become terrorists again? Maybe like Omar Khadr. Among the questions not asked was what happened to the elected legislature in Palestine. Remember, there was a free election, carefully monitored election back in January 2006, and not long after that, the United States and the European Union and Israel dissolved the only freely elected legislature in the Arab world and went off to prison along with the cabinet. And they're unpeople, so don't have to worry about that. Also unmentioned were two brothers, the Muammar brothers, a doctor and his brother. They were kidnapped by the Israeli army one day before Gilad Shalit was captured at the border. The Israeli army invaded Gaza, went into Gaza City, picked up the two brothers, kidnapped them, took them across the border, violation of the Geneva Conventions, of course, and they disappeared somewhere into Israel's prison systems. I don't know what happened to them. I can't try to find out, but can't. It's not that this is unknown, incidentally. There were kind of a few sentences in the press about the kidnapping. There are plenty of other, incidentally, whatever one thinks about the capture of a soldier of an attacking army, which is what Gilad Shalit was. Whatever one thinks about that, if people are involved, the kidnapping of civilians is an incomparably worse crime. But the difference in treatment, again, reflects the difference between people and unpeople. Now, there are plenty of others in prison, hundreds of them. In fact, we don't know how many. Often without charge, hundreds without charge, thousands of others. And there are plenty of others we don't know about, because there also are secret prisons. Now, this was revealed in Israel a couple of years ago, reported in Europe, not mentioned in the United States, I don't know about here. There was a long exposure by an Israeli reporter of one of these secret prisons, Facility 1391, about what you'd expect of a secret prison without Red Cross or any other access, but again, no particular interest. They are unpeople. In fact, the racism is so profound that it's kind of like the air you breathe. It's just part of the atmosphere. You don't notice it. Well, according to Western doctrine, negotiations have been proceeding under the supervision of the United States, honest broker, desperately trying to bring together these two irrational opponents. who are recalcitrant. You can move from doctrine to the real world, and then you find a rather different picture. If there were real negotiations, they would be directed by some, they would be under the supervision of some neutral party, maybe a country that has a certain amount of respect in the world, maybe Brazil. And on one side of the negotiations, there'd be the U.S. and Israel. On the other side, there'd be the world. That's not an exaggeration. And in fact, it's very it's extremely clear from the diplomatic record. Now, let me just mention a few high points or maybe low points, just going back through the last 40 years very quickly. In 1971, the president of Egypt, President Sadat, offered Israel a full peace treaty, full, in return for withdrawal of Israel from, he said, occupied territories, but all he cared about was the Sinai. So, in effect, withdraw from the Sinai, you have a full peace treaty. There was nothing in it about the Palestinians. They were just mentioned as refugees, so nothing about Palestinian rights. Jordan made a similar offer a year later. Israel, I don't think, even responded to the Jordanian offer, but they did consider the Egyptian offer, rejected it because they did not want to withdraw from the Sinai. At that point, Israel had been was beginning to implement massive programs of development in the Egyptian Sinai. They were, Israeli army moved in, kicked out thousands of Bedouin farmers, drove them into the desert, destroyed towns and villages. They were planning to, in fact, did proceed to develop a major city, Yamit, on the coast, and a lot of settlements inland, sort of hinterland. And that was a big program. They didn't want to a peace agreement wasn't sufficient for that. That was a very fateful moment in Israeli policy. That's a clear point at which they had a choice between security and expansion. Peace treaty with Egypt, a real peace treaty, would mean essentially complete security. There's no other Arab military force. And remember, nothing about the Palestinians. That didn't come up. And the choice was security versus expansion, and expansion won flat out. And that's been policy ever since. Well, as always, the crucial question is, what's the United States going to do? That determines what's going to happen. And it was debated in the U.S. government. There was a split. The State Department was in favor of accepting the proposal, which is pretty much in line with what was formal U.S. policy. Operative is always a different question. The National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger, was strongly against it. He was in favor of what he calls stalemate, meaning no negotiations, just force. That's pretty typical of Kissinger's diplomacy. That's why he's called a famous realist. So he rejected it, and in the bureaucratic infighting, Kissinger won out. So the United States and Israel therefore rejected this offer. Well, that was pretty significant. President Sadat continued to make efforts to get the United States to and Israel to pull out of the Sinai, and he warned that if they didn't do it, there would be a war. Well, nobody took him seriously. It was a period of extreme racism in Israel. Some pretty good literature about this. I haven't been able to get anyone to translate it into English, but it's quite good. Actually, it's in French, if you happen to read French. It's a book by Amnon Kapeliuk, very good Israeli journalist in Hebrew, translated in French. But the general picture is that there was a conception in Israel, it's called the conception, in fact, a conception that Arabs don't know which end of the gun to hold, so it doesn't matter what they say, we'll just do what we like. And that was the U.S. position as well. So, for example, when Sadat was placing pretty substantial armies on the Suez Canal. Israel, of course, knew about it, but they didn't pay any attention. They left the other side of the canal virtually undefended. Well, then came the 1973 war, which was a very close thing for Israel, very close. It was a desperate situation, actually almost led to a nuclear war, a major nuclear war. It was not trivial. Well, finally, that ended, and for Kissinger, the clouds lifted. He does understand force, and Israel understood that they better pay some attention to Egypt instead of just dismissing them. Then starts the famous shuttle diplomacy, finally leading to the Camp David peace treaty, 1979, which was very similar to the peace treaty that the United States and Israel rejected in 1971, except from their point of view, harsher, because during those years, the mid-70s, the question of Palestinian national rights had entered the international agenda. So in 79, the U.S. and Israel were compelled to make some gestures about Palestinian national rights, which of course they then proceeded to violate, but it was a harsher position that they accepted than the one they'd rejected in 1971. Well, you look at the literature, the Camp David agreements are regarded as a great diplomatic triumph for Henry Kissinger, President Carter, and so on. The reality is they were a diplomatic catastrophe. The U.S. and Israel turned down a peace offer in 1971, that led to a major war, a very serious war, not only for Israel and Egypt and Syria, but also globally. The U.S. and Russia came close to a nuclear war. And then finally, the U.S. and Israel accepted a version of Sadat's 1971 offer, which was harsher from their point of view than the one they'd rejected. In an honest history, that'd be called a diplomatic catastrophe. But take a look at the way it's treated in academic and general history, and you learn something about ourselves. Meanwhile, other things had been happening. As I mentioned, the issue of Palestinian national rights entered the international agenda very explicitly. In January 1976, the three major Arab states, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, brought a resolution to the Security Council of the United Nations, which called for a two-state settlement along the international border. That's the first official proposal of the two-state settlement idea, which is an overwhelming international consensus by now. And they included in the resolution the major wording of resolution UN 242, which everybody on all sides regards as the kind of core diplomatic resolution, which incidentally says nothing about the Palestinians. So the 1976 resolution called for recognition of the rights of every state in the region, including Israel and the new Palestinian state, the right to live within, the right to exist within secure and recognized borders. That's the basic wording of 242. That's in the January 76 resolution. That was vetoed by the United States. And a U.S. veto is a double veto. First of all, the resolution is blocked, and it's also eliminated from history. Check and find out. Look at the academic scholarly studies, the general reporting and so on, and you have to go pretty far to find even a recognition that any of this existed, but it existed, and you can easily discover it. In 1980, again, there was a similar resolution, again vetoed by the United States, therefore out of history. At that point, the debate in the United Security Council was blocked. Debate shifted over to the General Assembly. I won't run through the history, but a year after year, if you check, there's a General Assembly resolution with somewhat similar content, and you get votes like 151-3, the United States, Israel, and Marshall Islands or something else. And that goes on year after year, but all of that's kind of out of history too. In 1988, something important happened. Palestinian National Council officially accepted the international consensus on a two-state settlement. And of course, Israel and the U.S. responded. The response, Israel immediately, they had a coalition government then, Labor, Likud government, Yitzhak Shamir, Shimon Peres. The government issued a formal response. The response said that there can be no additional Palestinian state between Jordan and Israel, and the outcome of what happens in the occupied territories will have to be settled according to the guidelines of the State of Israel. Notice the phrase, additional Palestinian state. They were declaring that Jordan is a Palestinian state. Of course, the Jordanians don't agree, and the Palestinians don't agree, but since they're unpeople, their voices don't matter any more than that of their camels and donkeys. So there can't be an additional Palestinian state, and everything will have to be settled along with Israeli guidelines. Again, you're going to have to search pretty far to find a record of this, but it's there. Well, the question is always, is how's the U.S. going to respond? And it responded. That was the first Bush administration. James Baker was Secretary of State. And a few months later, Baker issued the Baker Plan, which simply reiterated the Israeli position. No additional Palestinian state. Fate of the territories will be settled along the guidelines of Israel. Not reported, incidentally, but it's there in the record. I can give you sources if you like. Well, shortly after that comes the Oslo. There were, by that point, negotiations beginning, the Madrid negotiations. Then came Oslo, which undercut them. To discuss what happened then, but I won't go into it. Anyway, the Oslo negotiations undercut the Palestinian negotiators for interesting reasons, and that led to the famous event on the White House lawn, President Clinton standing over the two antagonists, Rabin and Arafat, and Rabin reluctantly shook hands with Arafat. That was described in the U.S. press as a day of awe, and that's the way it was treated, in fact. And not everyone was enthralled. Most people were. Edward Said was, in fact, one of the few who recognized at once what was happening. I spoke and wrote about it, too, along with a very tiny handful of others. The most important reaction was by Haider al-Shafi. He was the chief, he's probably the most respected person in the occupied territories, a dedicated, honest nationalist, and also the chief negotiator for the Palestinians in the Madrid Accords. He was undercut. He refused even to attend the ceremony on the White House lawn, and he strongly opposed the agreement because of its content. What was its content? Well, there was a declaration of principles. You know, famous declaration of principles that was agreed on. If you bother reading it, you'll understand right away why it was just a total sellout of the Palestinians. The declaration of principles states that the ultimate outcome, the final outcome of negotiations after they continue on in terms of the Oslo process, the final outcome will be a settlement in accordance with UN 242. UN 242, crucially, mentions nothing about Palestinian rights. If you read it, you see Palestinians are mentioned as refugees. Maybe we should be nice to the refugees. But nothing about Palestinian national rights. Now, there are further UN resolutions, of course, in all those years which did refer to Palestinian national rights, but they're including the vetoed Security Council resolutions, but they're ignored. Well, that's the final outcome. Furthermore, there was nothing in the Oslo Agreement that blocked further settlement expansion, and that was the, which of course undermines any possibility of any kind of diplomatic arrangement. And Haider al-Shafi, for that reason, just refused to attend. And then through the 90s, settlement expansion continued almost linearly. So about, you take a look at the record, just keeps going straight up. The peak year of settlements was actually the year 2000, about 40% higher than the last year. It was another policy that the U.S. and Israel were following, and that was to separate Gaza from the West Bank. Now, the Oslo agreements declare that they are a territorial unity, but the U.S. and Israel never intended to accept that, and they began to move right away in the early 90s to break them apart. Now, that's pretty crucial, because it means that if ever there is some kind of limited Palestinian self-determination in the West Bank, it'll be imprisoned. The only outlet to the rest of the world would be through Gaza, but that's going to be separated, and that continues right to the present. Well, that's the famous Oslo process. Again, a lot to say about it. It should be recognized, in fact, remember, you know, because it is recognized, that all the settlements are illegal, not just settlement expansion. The very existence of every single settlement is itself illegal. And that's not, it's not really in doubt. That's been determined by every relevant, significant legal authority, the UN Security Council, the International Court of Justice. In fact, Israel itself recognized it back in 1967, late 67, when the settlement project was beginning. Israel was informed by its top legal advisor, a well-known figure in international law, Teodor Meron, informed the government that, of course, the settlements are illegal. It's illegal to transfer population into occupied territory. It's a core principle of the Geneva Conventions, a core element of international law. And the Israeli Attorney General confirmed that. He said, yes, it's illegal. One of the most interesting reactions was Moshe Dayan. He's kind of at the dovish end of the Israeli spectrum. He actually had some sympathy for Palestinians. He was a defense minister, and he was in charge of the occupied territories. And when all of this was discussed, he said, yeah, of course, it's illegal, but states violate international law, so we'll do it anyway, meaning, hidden meaning, as long as the U.S. is backing us, international law doesn't matter. He then produced an interesting image. He said it's kind of like Bedouin culture. A Bedouin man like some young woman, so he captures her, rapes her, forces her to be his wife. She doesn't like it, but over time she kind of comes to accept it. So that's what it'll be like in the occupied territories. That's 1967. And of course, in what's called Jerusalem, a vastly expanded area, which Israel has annexed in violation of Security Council orders, there, in that whole region, settlements are doubly illegal. First, because all settlements are illegal, and secondly, because Jerusalem is the subject of explicit Security Council resolutions going back to 1968, ordering that any modification of the status of Jerusalem be stopped. At that point, the U.S. went along with the resolutions. The U.S. was still part of the world back then. But, you know, what does it matter, really? The creatures who are being harmed are unpeople, So that isn't very interesting, except maybe to animal rights activists. And in fact, there's no comment about it. Well, there is one interesting break in this series of events. The last month of President Clinton's term in office, January 2001, very instructive events took place. Clinton recognized that there had been negotiations at Camp David in the year 2000. They broke down. The official story is, you know, Palestinians are responsible. Clinton knew better. After they broke down, he recognized that openly that no Palestinians could possibly accept the terms that Israel and the United States had proposed at Camp David, and he presented what he called his parameters. This is December 2000, a couple of months after Camp David. Now, the parameters are kind of vague, but they were more forthcoming. And then a couple days later, Clinton made a speech in which he said that both sides have accepted his parameters, that both sides had reservations. They then met in Taba, Egypt, to try to iron out their reservations, January 2001. And we have a pretty extensive record of those negotiations. And most of it's unfortunately in Hebrew, a very extensive Hebrew record, but a lot of it's in English. And there's also an international observer from Spain, Martinez, who gave his interpretation, and you can find it also in the Israeli press translations. And they all agree on what happened. And they agree that the final press conference of the two sides stated that they were coming pretty close to a settlement. The settlement was along the lines of the international consensus, but the international consensus, everyone knows, two-state settlement, international border, and various modalities for the other problems that arise. And they were coming pretty close to that. There were still some problems, and they said in their final press conference that if they had a little more time, they might iron out everything, which would have resolved it. Well, Israel called off the negotiations prematurely, and that ended formal negotiations between the two sides. But that sort of tells us something. It tells us that the international consensus, and it's only that term is correct, it includes every relevant party, Arab League, Organization of Islamic States, which includes Iran, Hamas, just about everyone, at least on paper, except the U.S. and Israel. It came very close. That ended the formal negotiations. But international diplomacy continued. The main next step, a couple of years later, was the formation of what's called a quartet, the U.S., Europe, Russia, and the United Nations. And the quartet issued what they call their roadmap, which was a series of steps to be taken to lead to a settlement. Hamas is constantly denounced for failing to agree to the roadmap. You have to look harder to find the fact that Israel instantly rejected the roadmap. Now, they did it in the usual way in which states behave. Said, fine, we accept it, but we add reservations. And they added 14 reservations. You bother to read the reservations, that's the end of the roadmap. This has been kept quite quiet. Activists know about it, and people talk about it in meetings like this. But there was nothing mentioned in it publicly until President Carter's book appeared. You remember this book, Peace or Apartheid. His book caused a huge furor, bitterly denounced every imaginable effort to try to undermine it, all of them, total lies. But one thing was not mentioned, the one part of his book which was important. It was the first exposition in the mainstream that recorded Israel's 14 reservations, which undercut the roadmap. And try to find a reference to it. Unmentionable. It's another one of those things you can't say. But it's there. Well, then came, going on, January 2006, the elections that I mentioned. There were carefully monitored elections in Palestine, recognized to be free and fair, actually the only ones in the Arab world. But there was a problem with them. The wrong side won. Our conception of democracy in the West is that it's not democracy unless the guys we like win. This is not the only case, incidentally. That's worth keeping in mind when you hear the, you know, rhetoric about our yearning for democracy and so on. This happens to be a striking example, but it's very far from the only one. Instantly, within days, the United States and Israel announced that they're going to punish the Palestinians severely for the crime of voting the wrong way in a free election, perfectly public, incidentally, and the European Union went along, too. That's when the sanctions begin and so on. You can't do things like voting the wrong way in a free election and expect to get away with it. The U.S. immediately initiated the standard operating procedure when elections come out the wrong way, organize a military coup. Happens over and over, you know, dozens of times since the Second World War. So they began planning a military coup. Together with the Palestinian Authority, incidentally, because they didn't like the outcome either. The coup was to be led by a Fatah strongman, Mohammed Dahlan, and it was to be carried out in the summer of 2007 to overthrow the government. Hamas preempted the coup. There was a civil war. The elected government won. But then, you know, they were all in jail, but what was left of it. That's an even greater crime. So that initiated much harsher sanctions, not just sanctions, bombing, all kind of things. It's extremely ugly. It's a very harsh siege. Well, the savagery of the siege continued. An important event took place in July 2008. A truce was signed between Israel and the Hamas government. Israel never lived up to the truce, its side of the truce. It was supposed to end the siege, those were the terms, but it refused because of Gilad Shalit. It said, as long as he's in captivity, we can't live up to the terms of the truce that we just signed. However, Hamas did live up to the terms. You look at the Israeli official records, they recognize that during the period when the truce sort of half-held, meaning they didn't observe it, but Hamas did, there were no Hamas rockets. None of the famous rockets were shot, zero. There were some rockets, but not from Hamas. That ended on November 4th, 2008, the day of the U.S. elections, the day when Obama was elected, and under cover of the elections, when everybody's focusing on that, Israel invaded the Gaza Strip. The military forces went in, killed half a dozen Hamas activists, and of course the rocket exchange started again. There were a lot of casualties, as usual, all Palestinian, and it went on for a couple of weeks. Late December, Hamas offered to renew the truce. The Israeli cabinet considered it rejected it, and chose instead to bomb Gaza. That's the caste-led invasion and bombing. Well, you know, in the West, including the major reports on this, like the Goldstone report, they all take for granted that Israel had a right to attack. The argument is that any state has a right of self-defense, which is true, but no state, or no person for that matter, has a right of self-defense unless you have exhausted peaceful means. Okay, and not only had they not exhausted peaceful means, they'd refused to try them, presumably because they knew they were going to work. If the truce had been renewed, it would have again stopped rocket firing. Well, then comes caste-led, shocking war crimes. If you read nothing else about it, I'd recommend a book by two extremely courageous Norwegian doctors, Mats Gilbert and Erik Fosse, who were working in the main hospital in Gaza right through this period. And it's a graphic, shattering day-to-day account of the horrendous events that were taking place. It's, you know, it doesn't have all the detail of the major reports, but you get a sense of it that goes beyond the reporting. They described the attack as infanticide because of the hundreds of infants who were slaughtered during this attack that came into the hospital. The U.S. blocked a ceasefire attempt. Obama was then, had been elected president, but hadn't been inaugurated. He refused to say anything about it. His line was, there's only one president, and I'm not the president yet, so I can't say anything. He was saying things about every other topic, but not that one. In fact, his campaign did issue a statement. They repeated a statement he had made in Israel on a visit the preceding summer when he was referring to Sderot, which was attacked by Qassam rockets. He said, if my daughters were being attacked by rockets, I'd do anything to prevent it. He was referring to Sderot, not to the infanticide that was going on under his eyes, with American arms, incidentally. In fact, the Pentagon tried to send more arms during the fighting. Greece, to its credit, wouldn't allow the ships to go. The attack was very carefully timed to end just before Obama was inaugurated, okay? Well, so it ended on, you know, making sure that he didn't have to say anything. And then as president, he is able to say something, and he said what he says about everything else, Bush's war crimes, everything he says. It's better to look forward than to look backward. So let's forget about it and look forward. That's a very convenient line for people who hold the clubs, not so great for the others. So then we get to the Obama period, which is in fact the worst period yet. It began right away. I can go through the details if you like, but it's the worst record of any American president with regard to this issue. One striking example was last February, when Obama vetoed a Security Council resolution which called for implementation of official U.S. policy. That was extreme enough, so it actually got some notice. This was a resolution calling for an end to expansion of settlements. Remember, the settlements themselves are the problem, not just expansion. Called for that, and U.S. vetoed it. That incidentally ended the discussion of settlement expansion. Since then, it goes on without discussion. And it goes on right now. So when the Palestinian Authority went to the United Nations a couple of weeks ago, Israel responded at once, very brazenly, by announcing new settlements, a settlement called Givat Hamatos. It's right between Bethlehem and Jerusalem, kind of breaks any limited connection, very little left between the two towns, which are, you know, within eyesight. And it was done explicitly in order to respond to the Palestinian approach to the United Nations. Well, that just happened again a couple days ago when Palestinians were accepted by UNESCO. Netanyahu, the Israeli government, responded by announcing new settlements, both in Jerusalem and in the West Bank, with a kind of an interesting comment, namely that it really didn't matter because Israel is going to annex these areas anyway. And in fact, they understand that they can do whatever they like because Obama is just going to genuflect in ways which are kind of embarrassing, actually, but it happens every step of the way. That's a change. Earlier American presidents kind of went along, but not in this humiliating fashion. So Bush number one, for example, when he and his Secretary of State, James Baker, were kind of offended by the insulting, brazen way in which Israel was expanding settlements right under their nose, you know, like when Baker went to Jerusalem to announce a new settlement. They were pretty irritated about this. And they instituted limited sanctions, real but very limited sanctions for settlement expansion. They were essentially withdrawn under Clinton. Bush number two went beyond that. The U.S. several times under Bush too, George W. Bush, ordered Israel to stop carrying out actions that the U.S. didn't like. Israel has a high-tech militarized economy. They need a market. The big market is China, so they wanted to sell advanced armaments to China. The United States told them, you're not going to do it. They said they were going to do it anyway, at which point the Bush administration not only forcefully prevented them, but went out of their way to humiliate them. They demanded a formal apology. They wouldn't allow Israeli officials, high officials, to come to the United States. And they demanded legislation to bar any such effort to reject the master's offers. That happened several times, in fact. That's happened before, but not with Obama. He just goes along. Meanwhile, the Israel and the United States are perfectly happy to let the negotiations go on indefinitely. Then they can continue carrying out the programs in the West Bank and Gaza. That means the takeover of the West Bank can continue and Gaza can be crushed. And it's getting pretty serious. UNRWA, the UN organization that feeds a lot of the refugees, just keeps the refugees alive. It's like school children get maybe their own only meal of the day in school from UNRWA. They just announced that they're running out of money, partly because of the U.S. withdrawal of funds after the UNESCO bid, and Canada incidentally went along with that. I don't know about Australia. They're running out of money, and they say by January they won't be able to feed school children anymore. And in general, that's not only Gaza, it's also Lebanese refugee camps. This is pretty serious, and not a lot of money. This is, you know, like $100,000 or something like that, just to keep going for a while, not huge amounts of money. And in general, the process goes on. Well, the U.S. and Israel do want the negotiations to proceed, but they have to meet several preconditions. Now, the standard line is that the Palestinians are demanding preconditions, and Israel says, no, let's just negotiate. Truth of the matter is exactly the opposite. U.S. and Israel have three crucial preconditions. First precondition is the negotiations must be under the aegis of the United States, which is a joke. You know, you can't have negotiations with one of the partners running them. That's the first. And that's part of Washington's long-term commitment, goes back to the Second World War, to make sure that it controls that region, important region. So the U.S. must run the negotiations. The second precondition is that settlement expansion must continue unhindered. That's a very crucial precondition. And the third precondition is, in fact, what I already mentioned, Netanyahu, in fact, openly stated it, that certain areas are going to be annexed, period. Okay, major precondition. Then if there were time, I could go through the details, but I'm sure you know how it works. They're essentially implementing what was called the Sharon Plan at one time. If you want, I can go through it later. Well, in disgust over the pointlessness of these ridiculous negotiations, the Palestinian Authority did turn to the United Nations. Israel was deeply concerned about that. Illustration of it was quite an important meeting. It was intended to be secret, but it leaked. It was published in the Hebrew press. A meeting of the oligarchs, the couple of dozen people who basically own the country. They had a meeting in which they warned that if the Palestinians are accepted as a state in the United Nations, Israel is going to face a situation of what they called South Africanization. Israel will become like South Africa, and the economy and society that they basically own will be destroyed. And that's not a small point. And they therefore actually urged Netanyahu to enter into a serious agreement to accept something like the two-state settlement. They had a specific proposal, not unlike what was discussed in Taba. Well, they didn't do it. The crucial question, and it's alive right now, is how Europe's going to react. We know how most of the world reacts, the overwhelming support for a Palestinian state. We know what the U.S. position is. The U.S. is going to veto anything at the Security Council, is working overtime to block too much support at the General Assembly. But how will Europe react? Europe's an independent force in the world, or could be if it wanted to. Well, they capitulated, as usual. Europe capitulated to the master. To make it very clear, they sent a message delivered by the utterly pathetic Tony Blair, telling the Palestinians, forget it, go back to the negotiations run by the U.S. with these preconditions. Palestinian Authority had the dignity to announce publicly that they were never going to have any further discussions with Blair. Now, the stand of Australia is important. Australia, of course, is not a major player in world affairs, but it's important nevertheless. And in the international arena, it's been unusually strong in support for U.S. policy, support for Israel. And I think a pretty good account of the reasons was given by the president of Bar-Ilan University when he granted an honorary degree to John Howard a couple of years ago. He said that the ties between Israel and Australia are culturally deep and spiritually intimate. And I think that's more than the usual rhetorical vacuity. And that contributes to U.S.-Israeli rejectionism, which is the major obstacle for peace. Now, in the contemporary discussion of this issue, it's very widely assumed, sort of across the spectrum, that there are two options. One option is the international consensus on a two-state settlement. The other option is Israel takes over the whole region and there can be a civil rights struggle, something like the anti-apartheid movement. And a lot of the Palestinian activists, solidarity activists, are actually proposing the second as a preferable alternative. It's proposed also by some of the Palestinians, Nuseiba and others. It's a total illusion. Those are not the two options. There's a third option, namely Israel and the U.S. will continue doing exactly what they're doing. There's no reason whatsoever why anyone should expect them to agree to take over the territory. They don't want the people, the unpeople. They can kind of rot in isolated Canton. Meanwhile, Israel will take over exactly along the lines of what they're systematically doing with U.S. support. Annex everything inside the so-called separation wall, vastly expanded Jerusalem, take over the Jordan Valley, which is important, arable land, a lot of water and so on, where they're driving out Palestinians, sinking wells, have a couple of salients cutting through the rest, breaking it up into cantons. I mean, the plans are very clear and obvious. They're right in front of your eyes, and they're implementing them, and that's fine. Big infrastructure project, so Israelis can go wherever they feel like. Palestinians will be up in the hill somewhere. We'll give them Ramallah, where they can have elegant restaurants and nice theaters, like any colonial society where there's something offered to the elite. They often live very well, in fact. And that's what's developing. And there isn't the slightest reason why the U.S. and Israel will accept the so-called second option, taking over the population. In fact, there won't be any what's called demographic problem, problem of too many Arabs in a Jewish state. That won't be a problem because there aren't any, they're bringing none in. They'll be off, you know, picturesque figures in the hills. Tourists can see them leading their donkeys and so on. But that's the other option. It's either going to be a two-state settlement or it's going to be this. There's no other option on the table. You can talk about it in philosophical academic seminars if you like, but it's not there in the real world. Well, of all the problems in the world, this is actually one of the easiest to solve. Now, there are plenty of problems where it's really hard to think of a feasible solution, like Kashmir, let's say, or Eastern Congo. I mean, really hard problems. Now, this one's quite straightforward. We all know the outline of a short-term settlement. What's in the international consensus, and there's overwhelming agreement on it. There's some problems, but they're kind of side problems. The main structure of an agreement is very clear. What's required is an end to U.S. rejectionism. Well, is that possible? For one thing, international pressures can make a difference. Here's where Australia can have a role. There are also internal developments in the United States that may be significant. Public opposition to Israeli policy is growing quite rapidly. That's particularly been true after the Gaza atrocities. They struck home in many ways. That's true within the Jewish community, incidentally, particularly among younger Jews. They're just falling away. They don't want part of this. You can see it very clearly on college campuses, where the atmosphere has just changed enormously. I mean, a couple of years ago, if, say, Ed Said or I were giving talks on a college campus, you needed police protection, literally. Meetings are broken up, physically broken up. I mean, even my own university, Ed had, was much more serious, but the police would insist on, say, walking me back to my car because they had threats that they were taken seriously. That's completely gone. By now, there are enormous audiences, kind of like this, a huge number of invitations. You can barely get a hostile question. It's, in fact, one of the major issues on campus. That's a big change. Furthermore, the major institutions have taken a pretty strong stand. It doesn't get reported much, but it is important. So Amnesty International, a couple of years ago, called for an arms embargo, no more arms to Israel, pointing out that they're illegal under international law, which they are. And you can add that the arms are illegal under U.S. law, too. In fact, they are. That can be a campaign that could be pushed. Perhaps more interesting is Human Rights Watch, which has been pretty quiet on this issue for the most part. But they've come out with some pretty strong positions. Just recently, about a year ago, Human Rights Watch issued a call to the United States government to withhold any aid to Israel that has anything to do with the occupied territories or with discrimination within Israel, like the report this morning in the Age. Withhold all, that's pretty far-reaching. They also called on the U.S. government to investigate the tax-free status of groups that are carrying out funding either in Israel or anywhere in the occupied territories that are either involved in illegal acts like support of settlements or discrimination within Israel. Now, that's far-reaching. If that were implemented, it would have a huge effect. And Human Rights Watch is not a particularly radical organization. There's another dimension which is significant as well. You may recall that General Petraeus, the head of the Central Command, a while back made some statements warning the government that Israeli intransigence was harming U.S. forces in the field. They have them all over in the Middle East. He was told to shut up, and he stopped talking about it. But others in the military and pretty high up in the intelligence system are continuing to say this. It's also coming out in the sort of right-wing think tanks, that one of the major military-oriented, in fact, Middle East-oriented think tanks, quite conservative, is the Center for Strategic and International Studies. That's Andrew Quartersman, for those of you who know these and follow this. They came out with a study recently saying that U.S. should rethink its relations with Israel. They may be harming U.S. interests. There was a pretty surprising article in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago by one of their lead correspondents, Walter Pincus, urging that the United States rethink whether it should be giving any aid to Israel. Now, that would have been unthinkable a year or two ago. It didn't even barely got a comment. Well, there's quite a lot going on like that. Well, suppose the United States shifts policy to adopting, say, the position of Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International. Suppose it was to cut support for the occupation. That is, take the position that the IDF, the Israeli army, must withdraw from the occupied territories. Well, what happens to the settlers? There's a myth that it's going to be a big problem because the settlers would have to be forcibly removed. In fact, that's not true. You don't have to touch the settlers. All that's necessary is to send lorries to the West Bank and give them assistance in moving from their highly subsidized homes in the West Bank to highly subsidized homes within Israel, and they'll probably practically all go. Maybe a couple of people want to stay, hang on to every rock, somebody from Brooklyn or whatever. Okay, they can stay. You don't have to remove them. You don't have to remove anybody. Just give them opportunity and, in fact, assistance to do what they want. Every analyst thinks almost all of them will go. If some of them want to stay, okay, who cares? They can stay. But there's no issue of forcible removal. Actually, the same was true in Gaza in 2005. There was a kind of a staged trauma, mostly for the goyim, as the Israelis put it, for the Gentiles. We got a stage of trauma when they decided to withdraw a couple thousand settlers from Gaza to make it look as if, we can never again, and so on and so forth. You have photographs, pictures in the newspapers of little children pleading with soldiers not to destroy their homes and so on. It was all staged, totally staged. All they had to do is to announce that the IDF is going to withdraw from Gaza on August 1st. The settlers will all climb into the lorries, go to their subsidized homes in Israel, but then you don't get the propaganda version of it. What made this particularly ludicrous was that it was a replay, almost exact replay of something they did in 1981 after the Camp David Accords, when they had to withdraw from the Sinai, meaning withdraw from Yamit and so on. And the same thing was done. Instead of just withdrawing, they staged a big trauma. In fact, I remember a headline in Haaretz, main journal, said, "National Trauma 1982," ridiculing the whole show. And it was redone in Gaza for propaganda reasons, but you could redo it if you want for the West Bank, but it's totally unnecessary. This is just not an issue. There are precedents for this. It wouldn't be something unheard of. The most interesting precedent, actually, is South Africa. There's a lot of analogies drawn constantly between Israel and South Africa, most of them pretty dubious. But there's one which is quite real, and it's worth thinking about. You go back 50 years, 1960, the white nationalist government recognized that they were becoming a pariah state. And we have the records, the foreign minister called in the American ambassador and said, things are getting pretty rough. Everyone's voting against us in the UN. We're becoming an international pariah. And he said, but you and I both know that there's only one vote at the United Nations, yours. Meaning, as long as you continue to support us, we don't really care what the rest of the world thinks. And that's pretty much what happened. You look at what happened in the following years. By the 1970s, there was UN arms embargo, then there were sanctions, even Congress passed sanctions. Had no effect. The Reagan administration continued to support the white nationalist regime. By the 80s, the framework was the global war on terror. The African National Council, Mandela's organization, was declared to be one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. That's 1988, late in the game. U.S. trade with South Africa continued to grow, violation of congressional sanctions. It looked as if the apartheid regime was undefeatable. It couldn't be defeated. By 1990, policy changed. Mandela was let out of Robben's Island. Policies began to shift slightly. Within about 3 years, apartheid was gone. It's not the only case. The case of Indonesia and East Timor is kind of similar. The Indonesian generals, right through 1999, you know, atrocities mounting, were saying they're never going to pull out of East Timor. It's province of Indonesia, as Australia incidentally insisted as well. In September 1999, under a lot of pressure, a lot of it incidentally coming from Australia to its credit, under a lot of international pressure and some interesting domestic pressure, Clinton decided to shift course. He quietly informed the Indonesian generals that the game was over. They immediately pulled out within days, allowing an Australian-led peacekeeping force to enter. Well, things like that can happen. If it doesn't happen, and soon, the prospects for Palestinians and I think Israelis and beyond look rather grim. Thanks.
Professor Chomsky has agreed to answer a few questions, and because of the size of the audience, people are invited to submit questions. We've chosen a few having regard to the hour, and we don't want to press Professor Chomsky too far. So the first question relates to BDS. Last year you were prevented from entering the occupied West Bank area in Palestine to deliver a lecture at Birzeit University, a sort of boycott imposed in Birzeit by the Israelis. You are reported as saying the episode makes Israel look like 1960s apartheid era South Africa, which realised it was an international outcast but hoped good PR would resolve its problems. If Israel is behaving like apartheid South Africa and is boycotting Palestinian universities, do you have a clear position on the non-violent boycott, sanctions and divestment campaign against Israel?
Well, I kind of remember what I said. It wasn't exactly this. I don't know where the quote comes from. What I said was pretty much what I have just repeated here about South Africa and the course of what happened in South Africa. At the time, I was very much in favor of sanctions, boycotts, and so on in the case of South Africa, and it makes perfect sense in the case of Palestine. But in both cases, South Africa and Palestine, BDS, incidentally, I was involved in BDS programs long before the formal organization of the group, so sure, I think it's fine. And in fact, I think the BDS programs will go far enough. I personally have advised and would advise that they go at least as far as Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International. I mean, that's not asking a lot. These are mainstream, pretty conservative organizations with a lot of public support. And I told you their positions. I think those are good positions. That's actually beyond what the BDS groups have called for. So sure, I think that's fine. However, like any tactic, whether it's civil disobedience, demonstration, whatever, petition, whatever it may be, you carry out any tactic at all, if you care about the people you're trying to help, you're going to ask whether that tactic is well-fashioned for the existing circumstances. You ask, for example, what's the reaction going to be to it in the audience you're trying to reach? This is kind of second nature to activists, except in the BDS movement. A lot of them haven't thought about this. The view that they're taking is you got to act on principle. It doesn't make any sense, not if you care about the people who are the victims, whatever principle is supposed to be. You have to ask what the effects are going to be. That's true for everything. I mean, this came up all the time during the Vietnam War, for example. I mean, there were groups at the most extreme end, the Weathermen, who were so, I mean, good kids. I knew a lot of them. They were so angry at what was happening. They said, we're just going to go out and smash up bank windows and so on. The Vietnamese were very strongly opposed to that. They wanted to survive. They didn't want American protesters to feel good. They didn't care about that. So they recommended things that, from the point of view of the anti-war movement, were considered outlandishly mild. I mean, I remember discussions with Vietnamese when they were urging tactics like, say, women standing quietly around the graves of American soldiers. They much preferred that to the weathermen tactics because they wanted to survive. You know, they were concerned with what the consequences would be of the tactics that are adopted. Now, you just have to take that into account. You have to make a distinction, anybody who's an activist, between what you might call feel-good tactics, makes me feel good to do this, and do-good tactics. It's going to have a good effect, and that requires careful thought. You can't avoid that if you're serious about it. And I think that the BDS organizations are on the right track, I think, but they should really think these things through more carefully.
The Arab Spring. In recent months, the Egyptian government has seemingly adopted a more pro-Palestinian foreign policy, relaxing restrictions at the Rafah border crossing with Gaza and brokering Hamas-Fatah unity and the Israel-Hamas prisoner exchange deals respectively. Considering that the majority of the Egyptian regime has remained in power since Mubarak's removal and still receives millions of dollars in military aid from the United States, do these gestures really indicate a new Egyptian foreign policy direction toward the Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, Egypt and Tunisia are the two countries where the Arab Spring has really had an effect. And not coincidentally, these are the two countries that have a militant labor movement that's been carrying out important actions for years, usually crushed by the dictatorship, though they've won some victories. Actually, the Egyptian movement, the Tahrir Square movement, is called the April 6th movement, and there's a reason for the name. The young professionals, you know, tech-savvy people with the social media who are kind of in the forefront, remember that on April 6, 2008, they were also participating in major industrial actions at the biggest plants in Egypt, calling for decent wages, the right to form independent unions, overcoming the disastrous effects of the neoliberal policies. They were mostly crushed by the dictatorship then, but they were recalled, and that's the April 6th movement today's. They've had some victories, significant victories. The press is a lot more free. The labor organizing is proceeding, which it couldn't do easily before, and there are other victories. It's also affected policy. On the other hand, the regime, you know, power doesn't say, go away easily. The military is still in control. They run a lot of the economy, and the U.S. and the West are backing them, naturally. So there's a the conflict is continuing. It's an ongoing conflict. And how it turns out will relate to this question. Even the small steps towards democratization, remember, means having public opinion influence policy. To the extent that that happens, you can say there's a functioning democracy. West doesn't look so good by that criterion, I should say. But in fact, you just saw it in Greece. What happened in Greece is just very revealing, almost like the 2006 election. Now, the Greek government proposed having the Greek people express an opinion on what's happening to them, and the roof fell in totally. You know, the U.S., Europe, utter denunciation. I mean, how could you dare allowing the people to have a voice when we made a decision about what should be done? I mean, the hatred of democracy is so profound. You know, it shows up over and over. Anyway, if to the extent that the Egyptian population has been able to influence policy a limited extent, it's been significant. A couple of important things have happened. For one thing, for the first time in 30 years, Egypt permitted Iranian ships, including military vessels, to transit the Suez Canal. That's serious. The Mediterranean is supposed to be an American lake. Nobody else is allowed in there. Maybe Britain, but you know, they do what they're told, but certainly not Iran. But they did that. They're also moving towards establishing formal relations with Iran. In the case of Israel-Palestine, they sort of pushed through the tentative Hamas-Fatah agreement, which is significant if it's implemented, if it really develops. I mentioned that the U.S. and Israel, since 1991, have been trying to separate Gaza from the West Bank for understandable reasons. And this unification move, if it works, would undermine that. It would also lay the basis for redoing something like the 2006 elections that were such a shock to the West. That's important. In the background is something very important. It's the 1979 peace treaty. Egyptians have not indicated that they want to abrogate the treaty. They don't want to go back to war. But there's an important question about how the treaty is interpreted. The U.S. and Israel instantly, and quite publicly, incidentally, interpreted the 79 treaty as giving Israel a license to do whatever it wanted. The Egyptian deterrent is gone. That's the only serious deterrent in the Arab world. Therefore, Israel is free to withdraw forces from the south, to attack Lebanon, as it did almost immediately, and to expand its operations in the occupied territories. That was explicit, incidentally, and you know, you can understand why. Well, the Egyptian people never liked that interpretation. The dictatorship, Mubarak dictatorship, went along with it. But that could be threatened, the interpretation. And that's taken very seriously in the West. You look at Western commentary, journals, military commentators, and so on, they're worried about that. It could reduce, and Israel and the United States themselves are worried, could reduce their flexibility to carry out operations freely. But they're very worried about deterrence. And so that's, just take a look today. A high U.S. military official today reiterated that the greatest threat to U.S. interests in the world is Iran. Incidentally, on the same day, a poll was published of European opinion, which said the greatest threat to peace is Israel. But that's their opinion. For the U.S. government and for Israel, the greatest threat is Iran. And you've heard that 1,000 times. You know, that's why you have to keep all options open, threaten them with war, and so on. What exactly is the threat? Take a look and see if you can find a discussion of what the Iranian threat is. Well, actually, there is an authoritative answer to that. I don't know if it's been published here, but it's very explicit. You can find it on the internet. I've written about it, and others have. It's given by the Pentagon and U.S. intelligence. They give presentations to Congress every year on the global security situation. Of course, they have a long discussion of Iran, and they make it very clear what the threat is. The threat is that Iran may develop a deterrent to U.S.-Israeli freedom of action. That's the threat. Nobody in their right mind thinks that Iran's ever going to use a nuclear weapon, even if they had one. The country would be vaporized in 5 seconds. So that's not expected. What they're worried about is that if Iran develops nuclear weapons, it could limit the freedom of the United States and Israel to carry out aggression and violence freely. And, of course, that's intolerable. If you own the world, you can't be deterred. The same is true of the Israel-Egyptian treaty. If it's not interpreted as license to invade, occupy, and so on, that's a problem. And that's coming along. How that will develop depends on the conflict that's going on inside the Arab world. The traditional ruling groups are, of course, hanging on to power as assiduously as they can. And the West, of course, supports them. The West is terrified of the idea that there might be authentic democracy in the Arab world. You look at public opinion and you can understand exactly why. There are good studies of Arab public opinion done by U.S. polling agencies, the most prestigious ones. And they're not reported in the press, but planners certainly know them. So take a look at, say, Egypt, most important country. About 90% of Egyptians regard the United States and Israel as the main threat that's facing them. They kind of agree with Europe. About 10% regard Iran as a threat. They don't like Iran, for all kind of reasons, many of them good reasons, but they don't regard them as a threat. In fact, opposition to U.S. policy is so strong that about 80% of Egyptians on recent polls think that the region would be better off if Iran had nuclear weapons. They don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons. Separate polls say, no, we don't want nuclear weapons. In fact, what they want is a nuclear weapons-free zone in the region, including Iran, Israel, U.S. forces. In fact, there's overwhelming international support for that. The U.S. is blocking it. But the last thing that the U.S. and Europe want is for opinions like that to influence policy. So, of course, they're going to try to block democracy. They'll say, democracy is wonderful, we love it, and so on, but they're going to try to block it. And it's an ongoing conflict. In the countries that really matter to the West, the oil dictatorships, they've held on very tightly. In Saudi Arabia, most extreme radical Islamist country in the world, long the major ally for the United States and Britain. There was an attempt to have a demonstration, kind of a day of rage, Friday demonstration. The security presence was so extreme that people were afraid to get out into the streets. And there was no protest in the West. Same thing happened in Kuwait, Bahrain. I'm sure you've read about it. It's been crushed by force. So they're hanging on, the important countries there, maintaining control. What'll happen in countries like Egypt and Tunisia? Well, you know, it's an ongoing struggle. It's not, it depends how much the protesters are willing to press forward. It's not easy. You know, they're facing very harsh conditions. It's not like the Melbourne police, who weren't very nice, but it's much worse there.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, because of the hour, I must now bring these proceedings to a close. To the Premier and to the Leader of the Opposition, your presence here this afternoon certainly does Professor Chomsky, the University of Adelaide and the Friends of Palestine much credit. And if I might be permitted the observation, in my view, it does both of you great credit. The Friends of Palestine... the Friends of Palestine welcomes the opportunity to meet anyone here who has an interest in the association. AFOPA invites any interested person who cares about his or her world, who is here today, who is not a member, to become a member. The Edward Said Memorial Lecture in 2012 will be delivered by Professor Ian Pape, world-renowned Israeli historian, now rejected by Israeli academia in his country of birth and resident in the United Kingdom. We very much look forward to his visit next year. Thank you again, Professor Chomsky, for your presentation and your presence, and I invite the audience to once again show their appreciation in another way.
Thank you all, ladies and gentlemen. Good night, and thank you for coming.